Let's open in our Bibles to 2 Thessalonians. I need a little bit more power here.
Yes.
A little more volume. 2 Thessalonians. We'll be in chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians, chapter 2. Well, a few months ago, A few months ago, I shared with you about a man in Los Angeles, California, a minister named Pastor Hinckley, who put into writing a prophecy that he had said he received from the Lord. He said audibly and very forcefully the Lord had told him, in no uncertain terms, that the Lord would come and, quote, rip all the evil out of this world on June 9th, 1994. Thursday, June 9th, 1994. And he was so certain of this, he wrote 3 pages worth of prophecy and distributed it to everybody he could find in his congregation and everywhere, mailed it out, went out as far and wide as could be. Someone gave me that, and it seemed to be a good thing to talk about at the time because we were talking about prophecy. Here, we were discussing not end times, but the subject of prophecy and hearing things from the Lord and so on. So we began to wait and began to find out, you see, if Pastor Hinckley was correct. Well, here it is, the 12th of June, 1994, several days after, we've given a few days for maybe he got his hours wrong or his days wrong, but several days later, and the evil is still here. We still have the same administration in control of our country. We still have some people I was looking to see if they would disappear. God was going to pull them off the face. Not so. I haven't seen any improvements in the cultural situation in which we live. I haven't seen any changes. Neither have you. But what are we to think of this prophecy from Pastor Hinckley in Southern California? Well, we are to throw it away. We are to learn a lesson about setting dates and about false prophecies. And we are to not listen to Pastor Hinckley again about these things. The Bible tells us this very, very clearly. If a prophet, it says something and it doesn't come to pass, you don't have to listen to that prophet anymore. Furthermore, if they take the Lord's name in vain, in the Old Testament, they were to be stoned. They were to be executed. Now, that's not true in the New Testament. They're just to be ignored. But I don't know about you. Most everybody I knew who read this prophecy that was all written out with all its they had a bunch of Bible verses and stuff. I don't know about you, but most of the people I talked to didn't believe it in the first place. They kind of had enough discernment to know that Pastor Hinckley might have been drinking his bathwater anyway. And they kind of figured out that this was just another in a long line of false prophecies about the end times, and indeed it was. In fact, in my years as a pastor, I have read literally dozens and dozens, and some of them very long, written prophecies from people who insisted certain things are going to happen on certain dates. And Pastor Hinckley can't even weasel out of this because he said Thursday, June 9th, 1994, and that can't be a year off because it wouldn't land on a Thursday the following year. So he's stuck with it. But I've read others in which they left themselves enough room so that if it was wrong, remember 88 reasons why the rapture had to happen in 1988 and then, I was wrong. I got, my slide rule was a little crooked and it's 89. So he wrote another book, 89 reasons why it's supposed to be in 89 and it didn't happen in 89. And then he stopped writing books. And sometimes they'll leave themselves this little out, but I have dozens and dozens of times read these prophecies, and I almost invariably will put them in file 13, and I tell everybody to do that. And they say, well, are you cynical about prophesying about the end times? Absolutely not. In fact, I'm convinced we're in the end times. I do believe the Lord will come back in our day. But there is no area of biblical understanding more abused throughout church history than the area of eschatology, the study of the end times and what's going to happen at the end. And there's no area about which there has been more foolishness and false prophecy given than about this particular area, the Lord's return. Ever since he said, I'll be back, people have been claiming that he told them when, exactly what day and all this stuff. It goes on all the time. If you've been a Christian for very long at all, you've read it, you've heard it, and maybe you've even been a little bit upset by it. Maybe you have been somewhat shaken. I'll never forget the first time as a young Christian. I think I'd been a Christian about 2 years at the time, but I wasn't really well, early in my Christian life, wasn't really well grounded in the Word right away. My fault, not the fault of the church I went to. It was an excellent church. But I just wasn't listening real carefully in my teen years for a couple of years there. And I remember the first time I ever read that someone said, and I won't name the man, but it was a well-known minister of the day, and he had this lengthy prophecy about how what God was going to do with America at that time. I was shaken. I was really upset. I was worried. I thought, oh my, the Spirit has spoken to this guy. And I didn't know enough about the Bible to see that he had misinterpreted several scriptures and that he was claiming things for himself that I didn't necessarily need to believe. Okay? As time went on, of course, and his prophecies didn't come true, I began to calm down a little bit, and I began to realize you go to the Word first, and then you evaluate everything anybody else says through the Word. But I was quite shaken up, and maybe you have been as well. You know, maybe you've had some scary moments where you hear somebody, they're even on the radio, you know, pay and preach. You can pay any radio stations, you know, Christian radio stations. Sometimes you can pay, and a guy will get on and say something. And it's not the radio station's fault sometimes, you know. It's a guy who paid, and he'll say something that's kind of off the wall. You got to keep your garbage detector on. Maybe you've been frightened by something like that. I certainly was. You know, we're not alone in this. And it's not just the last couple of generations. It's not just the last, you know, we're coming to the end of the 20th century. You know, we got a few more years, six more years to the end of this, this century and this millennium. Going to turn the millennium. And we're thinking, well, maybe it's just that. Maybe it's just this period of time that, you know, people get a little excited about the end of time, you see, at the turn of the century or the millennium. But that's not it. It's not just us, and it's not just our generations. It was going on in the first century. You know, almost within months of when Jesus ascended, people started to speculate about when he was going to come back. And false prophecies began to circulate among the Christians, so much so that several letters of the New Testament have to deal with some false things that go on. And one of those letters, in fact, one that deals most clearly with the subject, is in 2 Thessalonians. Paul writes to his Thessalonian converts, young Christians, about the second coming because someone had been lying to them. Someone had come to them and said, well, I have a prophecy from God about how this and this and this is happening, and it was wrong. And so Paul writes 2 Thessalonians for the purpose of straightening them out on some things, and that's how we learn from this. This is one of the central passages, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, one of the central passages in the whole New Testament on the subject of the end times. And I'm kind of glad that there were false prophets back then because Paul wrote to the subject and we were able to discern from that some wisdom for ourselves. Now, as we get into chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, what I want to do is just briefly bring us up to speed from what Paul has already taught these people. And then we'll see what was said to them by someone else. And then we'll see what Paul says in response. We'll see how the passage comes along. But there were two things Paul told them would happen in the end times. One was called the gathering. Remember in chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians? He talked about the gathering, which is the, well, we call it the gathering here. That's the word we're using for it. In other contexts, it's also known as the rapture. But it's when the Lord comes and gets his people and takes them off the earth. Whether you're pre, post, or mid-trib, or whenever you think the rapture's going to happen, that's the event. He said it's going to happen. He said the gathering is going to happen. And he also implied very strongly that this was an imminent thing. It could happen any time. And would be an instant rescue for God's people. So he had told them about this. He said this was going to happen. And the second thing that he mentioned was what he calls the day of the Lord in chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians, which is, if you remember, a lengthy period of time in which God pours out his judgments on the earth. I am among those who are of the opinion that this is a 7-year period of time. God pours out his judgment during this lengthy period of time called the day of the Lord, and then it culminates in the second coming. So the whole period of time is called the day of the Lord, but the final day of the day of the Lord is the second coming of Jesus Christ in which he judges the evil of this world. And we saw that. We're not going to belabor it anymore. I just want to point out, though, that Paul also felt that this was apparently imminent. He said it will come upon the world without warning as birth pangs upon a woman with child and so on. And so that there's this kind of suddenness that happens as the world begins to endure what is known as the day of the Lord. Well, what happened was that the folks in Thessalonica had heard these teachings and they were thinking, okay, Lord, you know, we're ready for you to come back whenever you're ready. And every generation of Christians throughout history has hoped the Lord would return in their era. And so they're excited about that. They're hoping for the gathering. But someone came along and said, you see all this persecution you're enduring? And they were enduring a lot of persecution. And someone who apparently claimed to be speaking for God said, this persecution, this intensity that's happening to you is the day of the Lord. You're in it. You're in the day of the Lord, is apparently what they said. Because in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, Paul writes to them and says, no, you're not in it. This is not the beginning of the end, he says to them. You're not in it because you're not seeing certain things that have to happen during that period, especially right at the beginning of it. You're not in the day of the Lord, he says to them. But these folks had come along, or somebody, had purported to have spoken for Paul or for the Holy Spirit or something, and said that they're in the day of the Lord. So these young Christians were all bothered by this. They were all hung up about it. Now let's begin in chapter 2, verse 1, and see what Paul writes to these people. Read down through verse 12. Now we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, that you not be quickly shaken from your composure, or be disturbed either by a spirit or a message or a letter, as if from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord is here, is the way that can be, and I believe should be translated. To emphasize, has come and is happening, because that's what the Greek verb actually indicates. I won't go into it, but that's what it indicates. I don't want any, he says, I don't want you to be literally, one man has rendered this, scared out of your wits. That's shaken in your composure, okay? It could be rendered scared out of your wits, disturbed by a spirit, alarmed by this false message or whatever, to the effect that the day of the Lord is here, happening. He says, it's not. And don't let anyone deceive you. It's not happening, and the verb from verse 2 is borrowed into verse 3, which is okay in Greek. That's the way it works. We supply it with italicized words, but it's the same verb. Let no one in any way deceive you. It's not happening unless the apostasy happens at the beginning. And the son of man, the son of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. He says, listen, you guys are all shook up. Don't worry. You're not in the day of the Lord, because at the beginning of the day of the Lord, right at the front of it, you're gonna see this apostasy and this man of lawlessness. Now, let me tell you right now, it is my opinion that the apostasy and the man of lawlessness go together. In fact, I think he leads it. It's just rendered the rebellion in the NIV. If you're reading an NIV, you're reading the word rebellion instead of apostasy. Good translation. But I think this man of lawlessness leads this thing, and this happens right at the beginning of what is known as the day of the Lord. And Paul says, look, that hasn't happened. You're looking around, it's not going on. So don't fret. Incidentally, he lived in a time much more dire than ours. We live in a time when, in all honesty, it's pretty bad. And we look around at the paganism of our world, the violence of it, the anti-God sentiment, even in our supposedly Christian culture, and we say, well, how much worse can it get? Well, my friend, Paul wrote these words at a time when Christianity was in such a tiny minority. It was having an impact. It was a tiny minority. And the whole world was pagan, and persecution was happening terribly against the church. And yet he still says, believe me, you won't miss this when it happens. And if you're looking around, and if you're not seeing this worldwide rebellion or apostasy, and you're not seeing this world leader, this man of lawlessness, you're not in the day of the Lord yet. So don't fret about it. That's what he's getting across to him. And verse 5, don't you remember, he says, while I was still with you, I was telling you these things. He apparently taught on eschatology. He taught on the end times and had told them to know that at the end of time, certain things would take place. Verse 6, and you know what restrains him, this man of lawlessness, now, so that in his time he will be revealed. He says the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. There is lawlessness going on. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That's at the second coming, at the end of that day of the Lord period of time. See? Verse 9. Now this one, this lawless one, whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, has all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they didn't receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they might believe what is false, in order that they may all be judged who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in wickedness. He ends in very sobering tones here. He says, I don't want you to be frightened, but I want you to be reminded certain things are going to take place, and that will bring about a judgment like this world has never known. And we've seen this on several occasions. We've talked about judgment. We've talked about that period of time. And he ends here in verse 12, the thought that he began in verse 1, with that same sense of judgment. But that's what's going to happen. Now let's go back for a moment and let me point out the four things that take place. The most important is the rise of the man of lawlessness, whom I will describe in a moment. But first I want to just look at the four things and make a brief comment about each one. And then we'll look at this man of lawlessness. There's some other things he's called. I want to go back and forth in some scriptures. This is a person who will arise at the end times. And we need to kind of be aware of who he is. But notice the four things that take place. Paul says, if these aren't happening, you're not in the day of the Lord. Number one, the rise of the man of lawlessness. He's the central figure, and he is a man who hates God's law. This is essential to understand. And then secondly, he brings about this rebellion against all that God has ever represented. The apostasy is what it's called. Not an apostasy, not just any old apostasy, the apostasy, which means this must be some major worldwide rebellion at the end of time. It is my conviction that humans don't live in a leadership vacuum. They won't just drift away from God. They need to be drawn to some other leader. And that's what this man of lawlessness does. He supplies that leadership that is lacking on a global level. And so everybody goes after him. And it is in that process that the great rebellion begins to happen. A great rebellion against what? Well, obviously against the law of God, against what God has said. And you ask anybody, whether they're a Christian or a non-Christian, anywhere in the civilized world, that they've had any contact at all with Western culture, you ask them, what is the law of God? They'll usually think of the law of Moses. They'll usually think of what God said on Mount Sinai, if they have any knowledge at all of it. And that's exactly right. This rebellion will be a turning away from all of that. That's why this man is called a man of lawlessness. And what he's going to do is pull people away from a traditional understanding of what God means when he talks about righteousness, from a traditional understanding of right and wrong, and give to humanity a whole new one that they're going to like a whole lot more than they liked the other one. You look around at the world today, and it's no big secret that the world doesn't like God's law. I mean, they can't even hang the Ten Commandments in a classroom for fear someone might read them and be influenced by them. If someone read them, they might actually be influenced to do them. That was the Supreme Court's rendering on that law. So the world is against God's law already, but this leader's going to arise, and he's going to pull people even further away and give them something new. Ah, we have something better now, you see. And this is the great rebellion. He also says that the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, but it's being kind of restrained. And when it talks about lawlessness, it's not talking about the lawlessness we see in the crime rate. A lot of people look around, they're scared by the crime rate, and we should be. But that's not what the Bible talks about with lawlessness. It's not just people committing crimes against each other. When the Bible talks about lawlessness, it's always against God's law. And let me say something. You can be a law-abiding citizen. In fact, I'm convinced the Antichrist will be a very law-abiding citizen and an absolute criminal in the court of God. You can have avoided disobeying all the laws on earth, or most of them, at least anyone that the people around you care about. And you can still be convicted in the court of God as an absolute criminal. In fact, one of the great shocks to humanity is that unredeemed humanity will have to face their Creator God, and He's going to say, here is what I told you, both in your conscience and in my written law. This is what I demand of humanity. And they will say, but we were never convicted of a crime. And He said, well, that's earthly crimes. I showed you in the law what was right, and you're an absolute criminal by these standards. That's going to be a terrible shock. You can look great and still be a criminal in the court of God. This ought to frighten us to death. In fact, it ought to take us right to the cross where God says, I will forgive your iniquities. You see? The law of God is clear. And furthermore, the law of God goes deeper than earthly law. Earthly law is concerned only with the externals, not with what's going on the deep issues. We can deal with behavior, you know, and it's kind of an impersonal thing. You stop this, you do this, you go this way, blah, blah, blah. But earthly law doesn't deal with what God's law deals with. And it is God's law that everyone's going to rebel against. And it's God's law, really, that people rebel against today. A lot of people are willing to obey certain regulations on earth. You talk to them about what God says about morality and righteousness, and they will just absolutely froth at the mouth about it. They're so angry, don't you lay your stuff on me, blah, blah, blah. They don't want God's law. Man's law is shallow. God's law is deep. Man's law deals only with the externals, not the real condition of humanity. God's law deals with the real condition. Came across that true story. 1992, Los Angeles County. A traffic control officer was handing out tickets for parking in the wrong places, as they do. And he came upon a brown Cadillac Eldorado. And it was parked in a no parking zone next to a curb during street sweeping day. A no-no. And never mind the fact that the driver was in the car. That doesn't matter. The guy wrote the ticket, reached across the front of the driver's face, put the ticket on the dashboard, closed his little clipboard, walked back to his little cart, and drove off in pursuit of other criminals. About an hour later, he got a phone call. Did you give a ticket to an Eldorado? Blah, blah, blah. He says, oh, yeah, I did. Did the person complain? No, not at all. In fact, I didn't even talk to him. Did you know he was dead? Shot in the head. Dead. Blood all over the place. This is a guy who needs to become aware of his external environment, this guy giving tickets. All he cared about was, is he parked? I don't care if he's dead. I just want to know if he's parked in the wrong place. You know, I mean, this is the way the world deals with life, you know, and God says, wait a minute, I care if he's dead. He says to the world, you're dead. And the world is saying, are we parked in the right place? And God is saying, no, my law is what matters. Not just your laws. Now, when we talk about the lawless one, we're not talking about a guy who parks in the wrong places. In fact, he'll park in all the right places. And the rebellion will be a rebellion not against law and order, but against the law of God. And it will look real good in terms of law and order, but it will be very anti-God. Okay? That's the situation that we're facing. So this leader is going to arise. He's going to draw this rebellion. And you'll notice, third, that there is the removal of whatever restraint is there. The restrainer will be removed, he says. Who's the restrainer? Well, we don't know. It calls him a it in verse 6 and a him in verse 7. That's strange. In terms of language, it's strange. Why would they do that? There's a couple of guesses. Nobody's positive how God is restraining this lawlessness and this lawless one. No one knows. Some people think it's government. I don't believe that. I tend to go with those who think that it's the Holy Spirit's work through the church and the preaching of the gospel. I have reasons for that. If you want to come up afterwards and this is a point of interest to you, come on up. We can talk it over. I tend to think it's the work of the Spirit with the church and the preaching of the gospel. Jesus said you're going to be salt and light. I think that that's a restraining impact on this world. And when it's removed, the evil one will have free reign. So there's the removal of restraint. You remember when you were a kid, did you ever ride bikes in the neighborhood? You always knew which neighbors had dogs, didn't you, when you're riding a bike? Sure you do. Sure you do. And you knew which ones were on chains, and you knew which ones were big, which ones were little, which ones had fences, and you ride confidently by the ones with fences. And the ones without fences, especially with big dogs, no chains, no fences, you would go around the neighborhood to get away from them, right? Because they'd come bite your ankles, whatever. Do you get the impression that God is saying here he's holding back that kind of lawlessness just like a dog on the end of a chain? And once that restraint is removed, it's just going to lunge. I mean, the world will be ripe for this kind of complete godlessness. Even though it'll look good, it'll be completely horrible. That's the idea. I remember dogs when I was riding. Scare me to death. They've always got, you know, they're always German Shepherds or, you know, Rottweilers. Why do you need a Rottweiler in a tiny little house in this tightly packed neighborhood? I mean, the dog runs the house. They let him out. Go run. Chase him, you know. I'm just paddling. My dad had a big German Shepherd. Always had German Shepherds. When he was a college kid, he had one. A big, beautiful dog, and he had trained him himself. But he was a watchdog. And he had him on a rope. And he also had a cyclone fence in the yard. And the kids used to come and taunt that dog. They'd throw rocks at him and yell at him and throw sticks at him and stuff. And they'd run their sticks along the fence. Brrr, you know, get the dog all worked up. And he'd run to the end, you know. And when they get to the end of their rope, it's doing. And they stand up. Rah, right? Well, that's what he would do. And the kids just got a kick out of that. Until one day. He hit the end of that rope and one too many times. And the rope snapped and he hit that fence at like 90 miles an hour and it was all teeth and saliva, you know. And these kids just, they left their clothes behind. They just, it was amazing. Dad loved it. And he did not cut the rope. He did not do anything like that. You get the impression when you look at what he's saying about the restrainer that the evil is wanting to break out, but that God is not allowing it for a period of time. But there will come a time when he will allow it to be all that it wants to be. See? So, the removal of the restrainer, and then finally, the great delusion. Look at verses 10, 11, and 12. Deception of wickedness to those who perish because they didn't receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so they might believe what is false. If you don't believe God does this, you should read your Bible, because in both the Old and the New Testament, when humanity persistently says, I will turn away from God no matter what, God says, if that's the way you want it, let me help you. Now that, some people don't have room in their theology for this, but it's true. On several occasions in the Old Testament, he does it. He does it with Pharaoh. He does it with Saul, the first king of Israel. He does it with evil kings during Israel's history. In Romans 1, he does it with the world. He says, I've turned some people over because they have totally rejected everything I've ever told them. And so I've given them over to this delusion. It's a terrible form of judgment. It's a terrible thing to give humanity what it wants. And yet that's what God does, finally. So this great delusion occurs, a worldwide delusion in which these people totally fall for this new pseudo-Messiah, the man of lawlessness. So see those four things, the man of lawlessness, the rebellion, the removal of the restrainer, and the great delusion. These all happen in that last period of time. Now I want to spend a few minutes talking about the man of lawlessness. He dominates the passage. I think he's the key factor in all of it. Let's see what he does and who he is. First, you notice he opposes and hates God's law. It's not man's law he hates. In fact, he will probably be a law and order kind of guy. In fact, the world will probably be in such a mess when he takes over that anybody who has an ounce of sense will say, this man's strong. He's got some real strong ideas. Let's deal with this crime problem. Let's deal with this and this and this. He'll probably be a real law and order guy. But he will hate God's law. Beware of people who are really into law and order, but hate the law of God. This is the stuff Adolf Hitler was made of, okay? And it is no better than anarchy. In fact, it's worse. It's the kind of person the Antichrist will be. So he hates and opposes God's law. Second, notice he sets himself up in the temple as God. Notice in verse 4, he opposes, exalts himself against every god. So he actually becomes an object of worship. This is amazing. People think, well, how can this happen? Well, the world just isn't rotten enough yet, and the delusion hasn't begun, but my friends, it will happen. Take a lesson from Adolf Hitler. I just finished helping my daughter with a report that she did for a high school class. And I was again shocked at how an entire nation, Germany, could have given their mind to a madman. But it has happened not just in Germany. It's happened in Russia. It's happened in countries throughout history. Madmen who take over the minds of these nations. Don't think that it can't happen. It can. And you say, well, will people worship? Yeah. If he does some miracles, if he solves some major world problems, and then says, well, the reason I can do this is because I'm actually God. You can actually worship me. Right now, that probably wouldn't work. But you let things get a whole lot worse, and you watch a few miracles happen after ages of rationalism where we haven't believed in the supernatural, and all of a sudden it starts to happen right in front of them, it will. People will believe it. So he sets himself up as God. Incidentally, sidelight, there will be a temple. There will be a temple in Israel. On the Temple Mount. It won't work anywhere else. Right now, the Dome of the Rock is in the way. Either that will be removed, or there is room to build the temple to the north of the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount. Plenty of room, as a matter of fact, to build the temple, if there could be peace between the Jews and the Arabs. What if this leader says, I can make peace, and he does, between the Jews and the Arabs? What worse conflict on earth could ever be dealt with? What more powerful demonstration could happen than that? And if he brought peace, I guarantee you Israel would follow him. They would. They're waiting for someone to solve the problem between the Jews and the Arabs. If this guy does that, even to the point of being able to build a temple on the northern part of the Temple Mount, that guy, the world will be a path to his door. So there has to be some sort of temple, because he sets himself up in the mid part of this whole thing as actually God in the middle of it. He's extremely deceptive. Note that. He comes with all deception, which means he probably doesn't look like he really is. This is the key to deception. You don't look evil. Satan doesn't come looking like a beast. He just is one inside. He's extremely deceptive, which means he probably looks great. And it says in other, we won't turn to all of these, but it says that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived. Jesus said that. Of course, that's not possible. The real elect will know. But this guy is going to look really good. He's going to be deceptive. He's also accompanied by these false signs and wonders. Don't believe that just because something is powerful and seems miraculous that it's right. It's not. Not necessarily. You go to the message. You see what they say about Jesus Christ. This guy is going to do miracles, and people will believe him. The only reason people don't believe miracles today, or a lot of people are rationalistic, is they haven't seen them. But I guarantee you, you have them done right in front of people, and the word goes out. All of a sudden, the public opinion will shift, and once it does, this man will have the world in the palm of his hands. Years of rationalism and turning away from the supernatural will set the Western culture up for a supernatural manifestation. False signs and wonders activated by Satan. And finally, you'll notice son of destruction, he's called. It means one destined for destruction. He'll be destroyed at the second coming. He'll be destroyed at the second coming. Jesus will destroy him. Now, I want to give you a couple of other names. Let me give you the other three names this man is known by. Just so you know, it's not just 2 Thessalonians. He's also known as the ruler who is to come. And I want you to jot this down, Daniel 9, verses 26 and 27. Daniel 9, 26 and 27. And I'm going to paraphrase this because our time is moving along. But some of you who are prophecy buffs know Daniel 9 real well. Daniel received a vision in which God told him how long it would be until Messiah. And then there would be a ruler who would come and make a pact with Israel for 7 years. This is the ruler to come. It's this guy here. It's the lawless one. And he's going to break that pact in the middle after 3.5 years. When you hear people talk about the tribulation, 7 years and all that, that all comes out of Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to the end of the chapter. So this man, this lawless one, is also called the ruler to come. Another name that he has, which is real well known, probably his most famous name, is the Antichrist. Now turn to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John 2. Verse 18, children, it is the last hour, just as you heard that Antichrist is coming. Even now, many Antichrists have arisen. And this we know, that it is the last hour. Actually, between the time of the first and second comings of Christ, lots of false messiahs would arise. This is his most famous name, even though it's only used a couple times in 1 John. Antichrist is his most famous title. And anti doesn't mean against. It means substitute. The Greek language uses that prefix not to mean someone who's against Christ, but someone who substitutes for Christ. Now, let me explain that. I don't think the Antichrist is going to be saying, "I hate Jesus." I think what he's going to say is, "Oh, Jesus is fine. I just have something a little better." And gradually people are going to say, "Well, maybe all the stuff that we thought was true of Jesus of Nazareth is really true of this person." And over a period of time, the deception will be complete. I think that's why Israel is going to make the agreement with him. Israel's going to think he is really the Messiah. The substitute Christ is the issue. And substitute, he's not so foolish as to say, "Well, I'm going to come right out and say I hate Jesus of Nazareth." What's to hate? Nobody says that. Nobody, even rank pagans, don't say, "I hate Jesus of Nazareth," because there's nothing to hate. We victimized him, not the other way around. They may hate the church, and they may hate the message, but they don't hate Jesus. This Antichrist isn't going to be against Christ. He's going to add to. He's going to simply say, "I'm better. I'm the fulfillment. I'm one more avatar. I'm whatever you want me to be, as long as you give your worship to me. And when you do, you'll be worshiping all of the men that have been worshiped through history." See, it'll bundle it all up together. It'll look great to anybody who doesn't know the Bible. It'll look terrific. So the Antichrist, and also finally, he's known as the beast of Revelation 13. Now jot that down. Revelation 13, 1 to 10, we won't turn, but I'll let you look that up on your own. That first beast in those first 10 verses is a world ruler who arises, and all the language in Revelation scares people, but it refers to a leader there. And he eventually becomes worshipped by people in the world. And then he gives them a mark at the end of that chapter. We won't go, because if I open it, I guarantee you I'll preach it, and we'll be in here for the rest of the day. But read it on your own. And he talks about this mark, you know, that he gives to people. Now, when you read on in there in Revelation 13 and following, this is a worship mark. And it's the number 666 in some mystical form. This beast of Revelation 13 is the lawless one, the ruler who is to come, the Antichrist, the same guy. And the reason it defines him as a beast is because of his character. He doesn't look like one. He is one inside. So he ends up taking over the world. And essentially, the whole world says, "Oh, this guy's wonderful." And then he's able to do miracles on top of it. And he can control the economy and make it successful. And all you have to do to join in is worship him. And he's probably the Messiah anyway. So you take this mark, and you're giving your loyalty to him, and you're worshiping him. And the bennies are, you get to do business in the world, because this becomes a mark that they use in order to get in and out of business at that time. The mark of the beast. Incidentally, it is a worship mark, not essentially a mark that has to do with commerce. It becomes used as the key to commerce, but essentially it begins as a worship mark. And I emphasize that because people are looking around on their credit cards and on their social security checks to see the number 666, and it freaks them out. And in every generation, you know, Christians, whatever new technology is coming, everybody says, "Oh, it's the beast. It's, you know, it's computers. No, it's credit cards. Oh, it's this or that, or, you know, dot matrix printers." I don't know. It could be, we're always afraid of whatever's happening. Let me make something clear. You read it for yourself. This is a mark in which the people who take it know they are declaring their loyalty to a person that is identified as the beast. It is a worship mark first. And they do it knowingly. Read on through the end of chapter 19. These people take this mark for the purpose of worshiping this beast. This religion is in place. And you don't do it by accident. I say that to kind of calm people down a little bit. You probably heard about technology, about the forehead and the hand, you can put numbers on there and all this now, and that's true. And that technology may work right into this. But Paul said, "I don't want you to be shaken out of your wits." And I would say the same thing. Don't be shaken out of your wits. We haven't seen we've seen some things that might work this way. We haven't seen the whole thing come together yet, so don't be frightened. So we call him the man of lawlessness. We call him the ruler who is to come. We call him the Antichrist. We call him the beast. All the same guy. He dominates world rulership in the last few years. Well, how should we live then? Folks, as you know, I'm convinced that we will be rescued. I'm a pre-tribulational guy. I believe that the Lord's going to get us out of here. I've also already admitted, so save your cards and letters, I've already admitted that I may be wrong. I don't think I am, or I wouldn't say it, obviously. But I may be wrong, and you know, we may be taken out after God's wrath is poured out on the earth. I don't think that that'll be the case. I think we'll be out of here before it happens. Nevertheless, when we read what Paul writes here in 2 Thess, we've got to say to ourselves, look, the world's going to come to an end. It's not going to go on this way forever. How should we relate to our world, knowing that these things are going to happen? Well, let me offer some advice. For Christians who want to think as Christians in the end times, first, don't believe everything you hear. If there's one thing I want to get across to Christians, it is do not be gullible. Do not believe these false prophecies. Do be skeptical of people who claim they're speaking for God and they're setting dates by God's authority. By all means, be skeptical. Take it to your friends and say, what do you think of this? And almost invariably, it isn't true. These prophecies are false. Don't believe everything you hear. Even from within the believing community, there are people who are mistaken. And furthermore, there are people who are just plain nuts. I mean, I love Christians. I love the Lord. I love the church. I'm glad I'm a Christian. It's a big family. And some people are missing some chemicals. And sometimes people say stuff and you think to yourself, hey, I love them, but they're just kind of off on this thing. Don't believe everything you hear. And just because somebody claims the name of God, that doesn't mean you have to believe it. So be wise. Paul says it there in verse 3, I don't want you to be scared out of your wits. Calm down. The Lord's coming back. Live that way. But my goodness, don't believe everything you hear. Secondly, don't neglect anything God has really said. Meaning the book on your lap right now, that Bible, my friend. Get familiar with it. Don't neglect what God has said. It'll save you from the foolishness that comes out in these false prophecies. God has said some things. The basic outline of what's going to happen is really pretty clear. The things that people argue about, timing of the rapture and stuff, are relatively minor issues compared to the broad spectrum of prophecy. So be familiar with it. Don't neglect what God has said. If you turn away from the truth of God, there's nothing left but deception. You will not find truth, ultimate truth, in the world. God says that clearly. Go to his book. Third, don't reject God's offer of free salvation. You've given your life to Christ, have you? My friend, if you haven't, well, then this should scare you to death, in all honesty. I'm not a guy who likes to scare people into heaven, but if that's the only way you're going to come, I will try. Because your motives will be better after you've gotten saved, and that's fine. You say, well, fear's a bad reason to come to Jesus. Great. It may be the only one that you're listening to right now. And so I will say to you, honest and truly, there is no hope in this world apart from Jesus Christ. Salvation is offered for free right now to you in person. So don't reject that. You remember at the end of chapter 2 of 2 Thess, verses 10 to 12. He says, this delusion, this judgment comes against those who hated the truth, refused to believe it, and instead rejoiced in wickedness. And the judgment of God will come against them. There's no reason for you to be in that group. Give your life to Christ. You simply say, I'm sorry, Lord. I'm wrong. You're right. Please take my life. And he will. And you too will be rescued. Pre, post, mid, leave the arguments to the scholars. Jesus says, I will come and get you. And if you don't know you're in that group, you need to know. Let's bow our heads, close our eyes. Father, we want more than anything to be people who understand the basics of what you're saying about the end times. And we don't want to be foolish putting all of our hopes in this world. Please open our hearts. please speak to the issues in our minds right now. Lord, if we've put all of our marbles in a basket that is going to burn, we pray that you would straighten out our thinking. And I lift up anyone here, Lord, who has not given their lives to you. I pray, Father, that you would draw them in even today. And we who are Christians, we ask that you would teach us to think wisely in these closing days of the 20th century. So much false prophecy and foolishness, and yet your truth is still here, and it is being discredited by this other false message. So teach us to live wisely, Lord, biblically, looking up for our redemption, but living redemptively while we're here. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.